corrupted nerds ensconced in the twilight of their bedroom, whether it be in Paris, Singapore, Lagos, Bucharest, or indeed even Sydney.
And from Sydney, or close to it, welcome to Corrupted Nerds Conversations, Episode 3. I'm still Gary, and today we go above and beyond the cloud. Our guest says cloud computing is inevitable.
Processing power has grown at about 25% per year and compounded over a period of 30-some years. That's a lot. But bandwidth has grown at about 45% per year over that same period of time.
So whatever the application, no matter how complex, it'll be cheaper to process the data somewhere else.
Your device at the edge only has to manage presentation and interaction.
That's Peter Coffey, Vice President and Head of Platform Research at Salesforce.com. He's our guest today on Corrupted Nerds, a podcast about information, power, security, and all the cybers in a global internet revolution that's changing everything. Well, sorry about the five-week gap between episodes. As you might have read elsewhere, I've had a few health problems. But we're back on schedule now, and we'll even have the iTunes feeds for this podcast sorted out in the next few days. But to business. Now, Corrupted Nerds is about the changing information flows and changing power relationships the world is experiencing thanks to this internet revolution thing. And while our first two episodes focused on information security and cyber stuff, well, that's far from being my only interest. I want to look at business and politics and family and education and bring you conversations with people who can help us understand what's going on in all of those fields, including this year's big buzzword, big data. And today's guest, Peter Coffey, is one such person. Now, when I first met him, it was actually back at the end of 2010 in San Francisco over a few glasses of wine at some media meet and greet event. And within minutes, he changed my mind about three different things. And today, I suspect he may well change your minds about a few things. Coffey's ability to explain things probably has something to do with his media background. He was a technology editor at eWeek for 18 years, for example, and he wrote the 1996 book, How to Program Java, which one Amazon.com reviewer has described as by far the best book that they'd read on Java for a person with little or no experience in either Java or C++, and you devs will know that they're very similar languages. Coffey graduated in civil engineering from MIT, and he has an MBA, and he's now with Salesforce.com, so okay, they're a cloud provider, and talking up cloud computing and all of this data stuff is part of his job, but he also does understand the privacy issues, as I think this example shows.
If you thought people were touchy about their money or their healthcare information, think about the impact of my knowing that your work calendar is blank, your home calendar says you're bowling, your car is parked in the parking lot of a pay-by-the-hour motel across town, nowhere near a bowling alley, and your radio says you were playing Barry White on the radio as you drove there. I'm going to know you're having an extramarital affair before your spouse does.
Indeed. This interview with Peter Coffey was recorded in Sydney, Australia on the 27th of May, 2013. Enjoy.
Peter Coffey, we've been trying to have this conversation for a couple of years now, I think. And when I first wanted to start speaking with you, obviously the word cloud was the huge buzzword. We're moving everything into a cloud. That seems to have happened now, and we're on to the next thing, which is big data.
I've been titling some of my talks recently to audiences with some variation of above the cloud, precisely because if you look at the level of search activity on Google Trends for the quoted phrase cloud computing, you'll discover two really important things. First, I firmly believe that the phrase originated in the customer community and was adopted laterally by vendors. The label that was being used for this idea by IBM was utility computing. We ourselves were calling it on demand. until well into 2007 or so. And then the phrase cloud came bubbling up from the marketplace before we and Microsoft and other IT providers adopted it. And I think the reason that that matters and is not merely an interesting piece of trivia is that people drew clouds on their whiteboards to say, I don't want to have to own this, operate this, or even particularly understand this. I just want it to happen for me. And the reason that's important is that anyone trying to sell you the technology that we use to do it and say, and now you can do it for yourself and call it your private cloud, well, that's exactly the opposite of what people ever wanted. Now, conversely, for the last year and a half, search traffic in the phrase cloud computing has actually been declining, and I think it's for the same reason that it would be regarded as a demonstration of your provincialism if you were surprised by the discovery of indoor plumbing. Of course there's cloud computing. What do you do when the internet is down? I don't know what it is, but it's not any kind of modern IT or business or industry or finance or education or commerce or healthcare or government. If you don't have cloud computing, I don't know what you have, but it's not anything that anyone would be proud to talk about doing anymore.
Well, before we just dispose of the cloud, at least as a topic for conversation today, I suppose we should unravel the threads. The fact that something happens on a remote computer on the internet, I mean, that's just the internet. That's not cloud.
Yeah.
We're talking here about, I guess, the two key factors, which were the fact that you did not have to manage this infrastructure.
Yes.
It just ran and automatically grew and shrank according to your needs.
Yes.
And a billing scheme that matched that.
Yes.
Are there any elements beyond that, I suppose?
Yes, there are. If all I do is take your familiar IT workload and move it to the other end of a wire, and if writing custom applications is just as difficult as it ever was, if providing new capacity takes just as long as it ever did, then there might be some incremental economies, but it's not going to be transformative.
Well, that's really just outsourcing, isn't it?
It would just be relocation, migration, same complexity, different zip code. The problem is, and this is kind of a six blind men and the elephants thing, if you understand IT really well and you understand that providing capacity means spinning up servers and you go out into this cloud marketplace looking for virtual servers, you will find them, and you will wind up building what I call a Jurassic Park, in which there are little pockets of preservation of the past surrounded by an infrastructure that marries that past to the present, and all you really do is compound your complexity at that point. You don't get transformative economy. Now, I'm going to share a piece of research that I just had communicated to me by some people at MIT last week. They've built a 2x2 matrix in which they look at two different axes of enterprise or organizational behavior. Digital intensity, which is the aggressiveness with which they adopt new technology, and transformative intensity, which is the effort they make at a cultural level to rethink what it is they do in a highly connected world of social graphs and mobile users and so on. And this is the fascinating thing. Organizations with a very high level of digital intensity, they're aggressively adopting technology, but a low level of transformation intensity, meaning they're trying to use that new technology to do what they've always done and just do it with new tools, they actually have profitability below average for their market segment because they're investing in a lot of technology, but they're not really creating new opportunity with it. While those who are high on both of those indices, yes, they're adopting new technology and they're using it to redefine what their product and service is in their marketplace, they enjoy almost 40% higher profitability than the ones who are merely adopting technology but not changing their behavior to take advantage of it.
Now, we saw the same sort of thing in the early PC revolution.
Yes, we did.
Revolution, that an office which ran on typewritten memos sent around by hand, the internal mail system, just put a PC on everyone's desk, a word processor, and email, but they were still using the same business processes by sending a memo to each other. It just happened to be via email. Nothing changed.
And you would have,
plus the cost of the IT.
And you would have managers who thought they were using email because once a day their administrative assistant would print off their emails and bring them to them, and they would mark them up with a pen, and their administrative assistant would take them back, and they were using the medium, but they weren't adopting the process. In fact, you can be really revelatory about this by observing that when the IBM PC was a new product in 1981, it had empty slots. One of the first things that large companies put in those slots was a device called an Irma card that was an emulator of an IBM green screen terminal. So you could actually plug the coaxial cable into the back of the unit, and there it was. So you could continue to run your familiar mainframe-based green screen dumb terminal applications on that same box while you gradually adopted these new things like spreadsheets and so on. Well, that was 1981. The last batch of new Irma boards was manufactured in 2006. 25 years later, someone still thought that there was a market for postponing the adoption of this radical new client-server model. And of course, by that point in 2006, we were well on the way to making even client-server look like legacy technology.
Look, I'm assuming that that's going to have been in something like a defense company or a banking organization or something, simply because I know here in Australia, the Commonwealth Bank only recently replaced its kind of mainframe-based core banking system, and they spent $2 billion or something on that off the top of my head. It's a once-a-generational kind of spend.
Well,
and the other banks are about to follow them.
And generational is a good word. I've been in this business for order of 30 years. I went into IT because I was part of the process of bringing PCs into an organization, and then I left the trade press and went to Salesforce.com 6 years ago because I saw another generational divide of moving to owning less stuff and getting more work done. And I think where we are now, where we actually see an implosion of market share for PCs of any type, because if you look at the universe of how people interact with resources, I think it's Forrester, or I'm sorry, it might be IDC to whom I should attribute this statistic, but by their estimate, 42% of the interaction people have today with digital assets of one kind or another is on an Android device, 24% on an iOS device, and Windows, which by their measure was 97% of that market order of 10 years ago, is now about 20% and shrinking. It's simply no longer the case that your mobile device is an accessory to what you do on your desktop. Rather, the other way around, your desktop is what you use on the rare occasions when you need to do something that you can't get done on your mobile.
Well, I'll put a link to that chart on the podcast website, because I have seen it, and it's just phenomenal. I think they headlined it, "The Age of Wintel is Over."
Well,
something dramatic like that.
Intel certainly appreciates that the trajectory they were on for quite some years. It was interesting to look at Intel's investment behavior, because in addition to building multi-billion dollar fabrication plants to build their chips, they were also investing aggressively in gaming companies and media companies and others who were creating the demand for this phenomenal growth of desktop processing capacity. We were seeing 4-core Pentium processors placed on desktops. Well, it's interesting to note that the most recent generation of software from Adobe, whose Photoshop was one of those things people bought a massive, capable PC to run, the next generation of Adobe is going to be essentially a subscription service. They are moving out of that business. And that, you know why that is? It's because during the 20...
People are paying $1,000, $2,000 a year to stay
up to date. Well, there's that, but it's just a matter of curves crossing, because if you go back again to this 1981 period when the PC came along, processing power has grown at about 25% per year, and compounded over a period of 30-some years, that's a lot. But bandwidth has grown at about 45% per year over that same period of time. What that means in practical terms is that what used to make more sense to do on a machine that you owned and had on your desk, at some point the curves cross, and the cost effectiveness of doing that on some remote machine is so compelling, and the bandwidth to that remote machine is so great, that the justification for continuing to turn the crank and buy more and more power on your desktop just falls apart.
And the economies of scale of putting all
exactly
of those teraflops in a data center
exactly
are enormous. In fact, a Windows developer I saw only the other day pointed out that there's a new generation of games coming out, fast action games,
yes,
where all the polygons are being calculated out in the cloud, and you just get the series of static frames at 30 frames a second,
yes,
or whatever you need for the game.
Yes. Your device at the edge only has to manage presentation and interaction, all the real competition. Because if you look at the so-called Moore's Law curve, You know, Gordon Moore was a semiconductor guy. All he really said was that the transistor count would double every 18 months. Intel today is building prototypes of a 1,000-core processor running at about 10 watts per core. That's an immense cost-effectiveness proposition when you consider that today a typical server costs as much to power and cool in 4 years as it costs to buy the server in the first place. So cutting power consumption really matters. And you don't get that exponential improvement on a desktop or laptop. You only get that where you have the massive aggregation of power of an Amazon Web Services, a Salesforce.com, a Google. This is where Moore's Law still applies. It does not apply at the edge. It only applies at these massive service hubs.
And it will have to now, because aren't we getting to the point where those transistors are getting so small and so close together, we're getting quantum interference between them, and we're really hitting a hard limit unless we come up with some new physics?
In both magnetic storage and in physical semiconductors, you're reaching the point where quantum effects and an occasional stray cosmic ray are starting to be like baseballs pelting you compared to the size of the devices you're dealing with. So yes, it's not an exaggeration to say that we're nearing fundamental physical limits on this, and the ability to continue to enjoy significant year-on-year gains in performance and reductions in cost is crucially dependent on economies of scale.
Which, in the political climate in Australia, is another big plus for, yes, roll out high-speed broadband networks, but I won't drag you into the politics in Australia, but it does seem to be that the argument of, oh, once you hit 50 megabit per second, that's four simultaneous high-definition TV streams, how much do you actually want in your household? But it's not about that. It's about this rich interaction where the interaction is being generated in the cloud.
Well, the notion that there can ever be too much bandwidth, I think, is mistaken, because when you have more bandwidth, you don't do the same thing at higher speed. You do qualitatively superior things. For example, today, if you're watching a sporting event, you can only see the view of the event that the director in the stadium chooses to show you. In principle, if you had a dozen different video streams simultaneously available in your home, the processing capacity is there such that your television set could synthesize a view from whatever angle you chose. That's the kind of thing you'll be able to do, and you'll take that for granted, that rather than relying on the person in the stadium to show you the angle of interest of the play, you'll be able to choose your own virtual seat in the stadium and watch whatever part of the game you want to watch. It'll be much more like a live experience. Once you've enjoyed that, what we have today is going to look like watching a slideshow by comparison. And so there's simply no upper bound on the ability of people to find value in a richer and more interactive experience.
Now, there's so many threads I want to explore. Based on that, Peter, this happens every time we talk. I'm going to pick one taking that sporting thing even further.
Sure.
What would happen to your local under-19s hockey club in a suburban part of town when just the parents fire up half a dozen quadricopter drones with cameras on them, beam them back, and this software is no longer the purview of a Google or a someone of that scale? But, hey, we can just do this for $25 per match, and all those kids' parents and relatives around the world can watch little Johnny play.
That's an interesting image. I mean, certainly we've gone from the point where receiving the occasional envelope of snapshots of the grandchild to what I enjoy today with my not-quite-one-year-old granddaughter, her father, my son, that is, and his wife, who are, by the way, both literally PhD rocket scientists, post video of their child's development daily, and my wife, who is also, in fact, a rocket scientist, will love nothing more than to discover a new video on the site. So, yeah, the degree to which we feel like we're part of her daily changes and growth, even though they live hundreds of miles from us, certainly it's literally changing the experience we're having as grandparents. And yes, there's no upper bound on people's desire to be interactive with each other.
And I see in that, yeah, there's going to be a great demand for a couple of those big Korean-made TV sets with cameras in them, one at the end of the dining table in each of two houses on opposite sides of the planet.
Join us
for Thanksgiving dinner.
Well, you're thinking too small. Corning Glass has two wonderful videos out there on YouTube, which you can find very quickly if you Google Day Made of Glass, in which they posit the emergence of delivery of information and rendering and interaction of function on pretty much every flat surface in your environment, where countertops become interactive displays, walls become interactive displays.
Microsoft have that running in their House of the Future demo
in Redmond.
Primitive version of it.
Yeah, well, there are two critical things to appreciate. Number one, I think Scott McNeely nailed this years ago. Scott McNeely at Sun Microsystems years ago, when he said, no one really wants to carry around a display, a mass storage device, a chunk of memory and a keyboard, and a radio transceiver. What they really want is to carry a token of identity that tells an interactive environment who they are and what they're allowed to see, and let the environment make sure that the things they want are, in an informational network sense, near them. So if you think about what a company like Akamai does, they try to anticipate what I'm going to want to have near me in a network resource sense of the phrase, and make sure that whenever I want it, it seems to have been anticipating my desire and be right there when I want to use it.
Now, as an example, that's the kind of thing that if I've watched episodes 1, 2, and 3 of a television program, there's a pretty good chance the next file I want is episode 4, so they already preload that on the closest server to me.
Certainly. Well, this has made our life very difficult when I was in the trade press and we were trying to do things like product reviews, because a word processor, it used to be one of the things we would measure is how quickly can you jump from the first page to the last page of a document. Well, then Microsoft, in products like Word, started to anticipate that if you're at the beginning of a document, one of the most likely places you're going to want to go is the end. And so they started prefetching and pre-caching the last page. And it makes performance testing tremendously difficult when you're no longer really measuring gross behaviors of software. What you're really measuring is the intuitive understanding of the developer of the kind of user experience that the user is going to be wanting to have from that technology. And increasingly, proper understanding and delivery of user experience trumps what used to be mere engineering skill in terms of the perceived performance that technology gives us.
Well, that mere engineering skill,
and I say that with air quotes around it.
Yeah,
I mean, I've got an MIT ring on my hand here, so engineering skill is not something I'm inclined to deprecate, and yet it's not enough.
Well, that's almost, you have your phrase above the cloud happening now.
Exactly.
And that's it. The engineering, mere in quotes engineering, is the standard foundation in the same way that if I'm here in an office tower in the CBD of Sydney, well, the engineering I take for granted. This thing will stay standing in a strong wind and so on.
Well, when I want to provoke nervous laughter from a room full of IT professionals, one of the things I will tell them is, if you got into IT because you just don't particularly enjoy dealing with people, I have some bad news for you. Your ability to get into the head of the people using the systems you administer and develop and to anticipate their desires and to consistently deliver them delight is actually going to be a major measure of your ability to add value to what you do.
Well, I'm going to pick up on that, because when Microsoft launched the latest version of Windows Server and all of their Office products in the cloud and so on and so forth, their pricing structure now is such that really, if you've got less than 20 seats in your company, and that's, you know, the heartland of small business, Soho businesses, it just isn't economical to run your own server. And yet, you know, you stick it all in the cloud.
You do.
Someone's email in the cloud, whatever it is, use Salesforce.com's tools, etc., etc. But there's an entire species of IT support companies that are guys who, until 2 years ago, made their money by watching the install bar on a Microsoft Exchange server get slowly longer over a period of 2 days.
Yes.
I used to do that myself.
Yes.
Those guys are gone. Microsoft's answer was, well, now you won't have to worry about that. You can now spend time getting to know your customers' business and improving their flow. That's not what these guys want to do. They want to play with computers.
Well, I've had a number of opportunities to be with audiences in India in meetings of their National Association of Software and Services Companies. That's what it used to be called. Now they just go by the name of NASSCOM, where I have spoken daggers to them and I've said, the business of feeding and watering the servers at a tolerable but attractive wage is simply not going to exist much longer because Salesforce.com, Google, Amazon Web Services, Microsoft, Fujitsu, COBOL, Fujitsu, Hewlett-Packard, and whatnot, we don't plan to leave a lot of that business on the table. If you look at Intel's projections, not Intel's, but of various people who watch Intel, the volume of shipment of new server-class microprocessors over the next 5 years is projected at about a 7% growth rate, which doesn't sound too bad. But if you look at the fact that the growth rate of server-class processors going into cloud service hubs, that's projected at 21%. So what that tells you is the market for the kind of servers you're talking about that sit in the back room of a small business, that's at best a replacement market and probably not even quite that.
Yeah, I mean, it was traditional, what? You'd have one IT staffer per, I don't know, five servers at one point, per 100 desktops, etc. Now, I'm assuming that any halfway competent sysadmin, if they're in a cloud data center, they're running 10,000, 20,000 servers.
20,000 to 1 is actually the ratio that I've heard used to describe Google's operations, and I suspect that that's about right, yes.
There's a lot of people in India going to be out of work, even though they're pricing themselves well. What am I paying? $15 US an hour for a systems administrator.
There are two phenomena that make the market of Indian IT outsourcing particularly interesting. Number one, the wage gap between, say, Silicon Valley in the US and India, which was 10 years ago maybe 5 to 1, is now closer to 2 to 1. And number two...
And hang on. Aren't we in a boom in Silicon Valley? Aren't wages up historically?
But the ratio between what you have to pay in Bangalore or Chennai compared to what you can get away with paying in Silicon Valley is much narrower than it used to be. And number two, I would never use this word because of its, you know, historical associations, but I'm going to quote an Indian executive as having said this. He said, "We aren't hiring coding coolies anymore." I have seen Indian firms say, "We are growing our revenue while shrinking our headcount." And people who thought that they were part of the India dream, they went to a technical institution, they got a certification, and they expected to come out and immediately go to work, they are now discovering that they may be put essentially on standby or on a sort of provisional employment basis where they might be called up if a contract emerges and might go for months without actually collecting a paycheck. So arguably, a phenomenon that took place in the Western U.S. over a period of about 20 years has now been reproduced in India for a period of about 2 years.
Wow. And this is of a quality, I think, with the railway systems, where in the age of steam, you needed X hours of labor per Y hours of runtime on a steam locomotive. You've got to clean the boiler tubes all the time and get the soot out of them. You've got to constantly feed and care a thing. When diesels and electrics came along, suddenly, well, the things just go. They just drive all day, every day, and you service them at the end of the week.
Well, even that is an interesting comparison because it's replacing one source of motive power on a railway engine with another source of motive power, but the railway engine is still a railway engine.
Are still trains.
Yeah. Now, to look at it another way, there was a time when a certain number of hours of a laborer would purchase the equivalent of a Ford Model T. And I did the calculations a year or two ago and found that the same number of labor hours at a prevailing wage would today purchase the equivalent of a Porsche Cayman. Well, that's clearly a much nicer vehicle, faster, more comfortable, more luxurious, and so on. But if we told all of the people who go to work in a city like New York every day that they were going to be commuting in Porsche Caymans, the systems would completely break down. What makes a city like New York work is that they're not in cars. They're in mass transit.
Mm.
And it's important to make not merely quantitative improvements to an existing model, but occasionally to recognize you need a wholesale replacement of one model with a qualitatively different model. And that's really where we are with computing now, because we've gone through several decades of a essentially familiar model of buying, owning, maintaining, operating, administering, owned infrastructure to get things done. And at some point, you have to say, you know, that's just not a business that very many companies in the world need to be in to do it well. Business aviation used to mean owning your own planes. And then it became administering your agreements with the airlines. Electrical engineering, when that discipline was first coined at schools like MIT, meant knowing how to maintain the generator plant in the basement of the factory. And then it stopped being that. And really, I think we're at the point now where starting a business or doing anything interesting or innovative in an existing business cannot begin with a conversation about acquiring assets to do it. It has to begin with a conversation about what services will we compose and marshal and apply to solve a business problem in a genuinely interesting way.
That analogy of the server in the basement being like the old steam-fired electrical generator in the basement of a factory is a very apt one. The mind shift involved in getting your head away from that, because there's still, you know, the if I can't see the server, I don't trust it kind of thing. And that's still out there, particularly in the smaller
businesses. It's a genuine issue, yeah.
I'm going to circle now right back to where you said cultural change.
Sure.
What are some of the things that we really got to look out for here in business, the kind of cultural change that happened? I mean, it strikes me talking to you that the whole bring your own device thing is just a bit of froth and bubble at the edge. It's like, really, whose expense account does the iPad end up on or something? That to me seems to have been a problem that's been and gone and solved for most companies. Mm-hmm. Like, they have to deal with it or not.
But the reason,
what are the big ones?
Yeah, well, the reason why bring your own device matters is that trying to restrict the employees of a company to a single type of device is as bad an idea as trying to restrict the maintenance crew to a single type of wrench. I don't know about you, but my toolbox has 4 or 5 wrenches in it, and I could probably get away with just one of them, but I simply wouldn't be as productive. On any given day, I may interact over a period of a few hours with an iPhone-class device, an iPad-class device, a laptop. And what's necessary is to get away from thinking about the acquisition and delivery of technology as being what the IT department does. The reason this matters is that if you go to an IT department and say, our people are spending more time away from the office, we need mobile applications for them, they will say, yes, sir, 3 bags full, and they will write mobile applications for you. Now you have all of your existing applications with the data stores and the compliance issues and the business logic that needs to be maintained and verified and so on. And now you will also have a whole new bunch of applications. This is the wrong way to go. You need to be saying, how do I put an appropriate mobile device experience on the foundation of certain data, certain interactions, certain business logic and interactions that I need to facilitate? How do I also, for that matter, have a war room experience? How do I appropriately deliver that information to a wall of screens with 10 or 15 people collaborating on it? Because that's also an equally interesting avenue to pursue. What this means is that the process of building applications for computers goes from being a process that begins with what code will we write and what hardware will we use, to a process that begins with, show me the scenario in which someone will be making a decision, making a purchase, enjoying some entertainment or other experience. It begins with a profoundly people-centered view of what is it that you're trying to accomplish. And that's a relatively new way to think about what application development is.
I can hear a lot of the mobile UX guys I know at the leading edge just nodding in agreement, going,
yes, they
yeah,
will.
We've been trying to say this for 5 years now.
And they're exactly right, because when you think about it, and this is something that Mark Benioff, our co-founder and CEO, has been saying for quite some time, is that every company today arguably needs to think of itself as an app company. And by app, I mean the very specific experience people have of discovery, download, and immediate usability that they've learned to expect on an iPhone or iPad or Android type of device. I just bought some window treatments for one of the rooms in my home. It came with an app for our iPad that allows us to set up, should we choose to do this, a morning mode, an afternoon mode, an evening mode. And with one tap on a screen, on any of several devices that might be lying around, the window treatments configure themselves to block the morning sun so that we don't get it in our eyes when reading the paper, whatever. Now, this is something that had a marginal cost of essentially zero to the window treatment provider. They already had the remote control. All this is putting a few lines of code into a device that we already owned. But it creates a differentiation in a market that might otherwise be vulnerable to commoditization. And this is arguably the only sustainable source of profitability in a world in which capital is mobile, talent is mobile, discoverability of a brand is trivial to accomplish. I can go out and promote my brand on YouTube and reach a global audience, as opposed to needing to pony up the kind of money one used to spend on a broadcast television campaign. The only way to make two functionally identical products different from each other in a way that can create consumer preference and brand loyalty is by an enhanced user experience. And as it happens, a straightforward and inexpensive way of delivering that user experience is to write an app.
That's intriguing, because the whole digital control of your window treatments, when you start explaining it, in my head, that's a luxury thing. But as you talk through the sheer economics of it, that's not a luxury. That's just, why wouldn't you? As you say, the marginal cost is next to nothing.
Yeah, if it costs the consumer practically nothing to get it, and it becomes a differentiator with negligible price impact but considerable user delight impact, then it's going to make those who are appless irrelevant in their marketplace. Now, there's an important follow-on to this, which is that in addition to increasing the usability and delight of the experience of the product, because the product through the household is conceivably connected back to the manufacturer, there's an opportunity now for people to know things about how their product is actually being used.
Mm-hmm.
And with big data types of algorithms, to detect patterns in product behavior that might provide very early warning of a product reliability or design flaw. And instead of waiting until the customer has noticed a symptom or a breakdown of a product, at which point the most you can hope to do is control the damage, now you have the opportunity for companies who are aggressive about using these techniques to reach out to a customer and say, you've had your product for a while, and you're probably very happy with it, but sometime in the next week or two, if it's convenient, we'd like to have one of our people drop by and just take a quick look and make a quick adjustment. Would that be all right? The customer's going to say, you're offering to come by and make my thing work better for me and it's working fine now? Well, at this point, this becomes an opportunity to refresh and extend the delight that normally wears off fairly quickly after a purchase. And now, instead of potentially having a defect, flaw, or breakdown in a product in a market like automobiles or appliances, this could turn into an expensive and brand-damaging recall campaign. Now you can reach out and turn that into a brand delight experience. Here's why this matters. There was a time when all you had to do is get someone delighted with the prospect of owning your product long enough to give you their money. And at that point, you owned them until the product broke down. And as long as they were satisfied, you were fine. Well, the problem is that today, the satisfied customer is invisible. They aren't out there on YouTube or Twitter or Facebook or LinkedIn talking about what a great time they're having with your product. And if your competitor is generating that delight, that's the most credible marketing in the world, is current customers talking about what a great experience they're having. Well, today, if you don't sustain customer delight over the entire life cycle of ownership of what we used to call the product, your most credible source of acquiring new customers is being ignored. You can't afford to have merely satisfied customers anymore. You need to be refreshing their delight in their association with your brand. And don't think that this is a purely hypothetical idea. There's a small list of brands in the world that pop up on surveys when people are asked, what brands actually make you feel like they're improving your life? Apple makes that list. BMW makes that list. Coca-Cola sometimes makes that list. The brands that work are brands that are indelibly linked in people's minds with wonderful experiences they've had, and now, of course, they can share those experiences with friends. I've seen some work being done at BMW where they're taking some video editing tools and building a scenario in which you essentially get handed a script. It says, give us 30 seconds of video of you doing this, 30 seconds of this, 30 seconds of this. You plug it in, and instead of spending an hour on iMovie, you get handed back a beautifully produced video of you and your great BMW experience. Now, of course, you get a few hundred of these up on a Facebook page, and you've got this fantastic repetition of a theme of, I have a better life because I drive a BMW.
And they're not actors. They're actual people like you. Yeah.
Yes, and that's the only believability now. So the product that merely is easier to use is just beginning to scratch the surface. The product that is continually telling its manufacturer about how it is being used and able to give early warnings, you know, pre-failure diagnostics, that you never have a product break down because now you can capture and prevent the problem before it even becomes visible as a gross symptom. This is key. Service becomes the new marketing. There is no silo anymore between the prospect, the buyer, and the established customer. They're all one pool of people who are part of the kind of experience you're trying to deliver. And your brand becomes your success at being part of the stories people tell about their lives.
There was one word in there I want to pick up because it's the big buzzword or phrase of the year, which is going to be big data.
Yes, indeed.
Big data is not just log everything and see what you can find, is it?
No.
I mean, it's
no.
It's a more disciplined approach, presumably. So how can I tell the big data snake oil merchants from people who really are actually making sense about this new buzz phrase of 2013?
Yeah. Big data is so important that if you look at Google Trends right now at this instant and compare volume of search for the phrase, quote, big data, unquote, to volume of search for the phrase cloud computing, quote, unquote, you'll discover that probably sometime plus or minus a week from today, big data will overtake and pass the declining traffic for cloud computing because big data is what people actually want to do. There's an important point to be made about that. If you capture records in greater volume and you look at those records in a transactional report generating type of way at a higher speed, that is not the point. Big data is being able to capture huge volumes of multi-attribute data from multiple sources and then correlate those in unexpected ways to discover associations that it would not have occurred to you to seek. And General Electric has some great stuff up on some public websites on how they're applying this to public health. There was one site that I ran across that took the three most profound disruptors of our time: pervasive mobile connectivity, social graph interaction among people and organizations, and big data algorithms. And in a natural disaster scenario, Typhoon Pablo in the Philippines, the intersection of these three disruptors was a real-time map of property damage, flooding, availability of emergency housing. If you try to construct a system like this from scratch, you'll spend billions of dollars to get something that may or may not be used at all. But instead, we're taking an organic demonstration of people's spontaneous behavior, which is to buy and use mobile devices to engage in social network interaction in a way that we can capture data from and then generate profound value from those behaviors. That's what big data is about. It's about discovery, not just about processing. It's about looking at things and saying, what questions would I ask you if I were smart enough? And building algorithms that will surface those answers before the questions are asked. That's why the discipline of data scientist is not merely the same thing as a database administrator with a PhD. Data science is a far more, shall I say, humble approach that says, I'm willing to let the data tell me what I should want to be asking, and I'm going to learn how to get my ears more open to those possibilities.
Given that so many of these big data sets are being compiled by incredibly large organizations for a whole lot of reasons, yes. primarily advertising at the moment, although, yes. hey, they've got the data, who knows what they might come up with. And I don't... I mean, Google is the obvious example, but let's not pick on Google because everybody's doing it down to
Certainly.
Whoever's putting all the ads
in. Where do you think Amazon recommendations come from? They come
Exactly.
from the fact they've been accumulating click trails and buying preference trails for a decade. Sure.
Where are you, Peter, on the spectrum of this is obviously a joyous big data future to we are handing over vast amounts of information about our personal lives to organizations we don't understand, who may do things with that data that we don't understand, and it may not be clear for another generation?
I believe that one of the most important things parents can do for their children today is to help them understand that how and what and with whom they share is one of the most important decisions they make about how they conduct themselves in life today. I think we've seen a younger generation that's far too quick to share things on a public network that normally only their best friends would know and that their best friends could be relied upon to forget. But now it becomes part of the permanent record. I have three sons in their 20s. I would like to think that all the times from the time they were in their teens on up that I've sent them articles about employers searching Facebook as part of the employee screening process, I'd like to think that's made an impact. I believe it has. And I also think that all of us need to do this. We will typically, out of a 30-slide presentation about the cloud, I have a personal rule of thumb that I'll have at least three slides on the need of for a, but again, I'll use the phrase that Mark Benioff has used, we need a trust revolution that's just as important as our social revolution. Here's the use case that I have shared on a number of occasions and, again, gotten nervous laughter from a room as they realized that they believe this, they just hadn't thought about it. If you thought people were touchy about their money or their healthcare information, think about the impact of my knowing that your work calendar is blank, your home calendar says you're bowling, your car is parked in the parking lot of a pay-by-the-hour motel across town, nowhere near a bowling alley, and your radio says you were playing Barry White on the radio as you drove there. I'm going to know you're having an extramarital affair before your spouse does. The ways that these data sets can be tied together. And, you know, this is only a very small departure from another perfectly benign use case of if I'm about to go across town and have lunch with four friends, it would be great if my car could tell me that the route I'm going to take to the restaurant has bad traffic. It's going to take an extra 15 minutes to get there. But on the other hand, the restaurant says the table's going to be at least 10 minutes late. And by the way, two of the five people I'm meeting are also going to be at least 10 minutes late. So take your time. That's a very benign and very useful use case for the connected car, the connected traffic. So there's an almost imperceptible boundary between correlating the same kind of data in a way that's completely innocent to correlating the same kind of data in a way that's potentially very troubling to people. You need to have a clear sense of who owns what, who can use what, and who can revoke access to it. And this is something we're really asymmetric about doing. Today, it's relatively easy to share, and it is relatively difficult to state with certainty how it has been shared and to revoke access to that shared information. One of the things that I think is wonderful about what we're able to do with our cloud-based business solutions at Salesforce.com is that we can grant privileges in very precise ways, and we can revoke them instantly in equally precise ways. Legacy IT traditionally has been not nearly as powerful or certain in its revocation of privilege. And today I think we have to have the ability to say, you can only see this until next week, and after next week, you won't have any access to it.
That's so much that we could keep talking about there, Peter, as always. But time has defeated us, but you've got a big picture, positive message, and you've got the product pitch in at the end. So that's truly good work. Peter Coffey, pleasure to spend time with you. Thanks for your time.
Stig, I'm so pleased that we were finally able to be in the same room at the same time. If we had had this conversation any time over the last 2 years, it would have been a different conversation. And the next time we see each other, I'm sure it will be different again. But
Will
thank
indeed.
You.
Thanks, Peter.
You've been listening to Peter Coffey, Vice President and Head of Platform Research at Salesforce.com. Well, it turns out that since we recorded that interview, the Google searches for big data have not surpassed those for cloud computing. They equalized and then both dropped. So I'll be asking Peter for a comment on that. Stay tuned. Well, that's it for episode 3 of Corrupted Nerds Conversations. The episode notes and links to the things we mentioned are at corruptednerds.com. And of course, you can also leave a comment. Now, from today's conversation, it's clear that all the processing power will soon be moving to data centers, and data centers use a lot of electricity. So you might think that this will be a problem. But in the next episode, you'll hear that data center power consumption won't be the issue. It'll be the billions of little inefficient wireless devices that hold the cloud together. Or not, unless we solve a few engineering problems. I'm Still Gerrion. See you next time. And until then, please spread the word about this little podcast. Cheers. Yeah, I know he called me Stig. I'm over it.